Wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion.
This is Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
We're in the new basement studios by the lake. We have a show simply entitled War.
Yeah, well, war in its serious and more, well, humorous isn't the right word, but
well, what is
unconventional
it?
Versions of war and things like that.
But what is it good for?
Absolutely nothing. So the first thing, the first topic we were going to talk about, which we had not planned at all, you know, Zeph and I usually email a little bit beforehand to say, hey, what do we want to talk about? Oh, my goodness, I don't know. And then usually we find that we'll 4 days before, we have nothing to talk about. And then by the time we actually arrive at the time, we have too many things to talk about. And so I actually sprung one on Zeph this morning. I was reading the newspaper.
Because while this show seems off the cuff, we, in fact, do plan.
Oh, yeah.
The goodies that our listeners receive from us.
There's definitely some planning associated with it. So this morning, it's Sunday morning as we record this, I'm reading the newspaper, and there's an article in the Washington Post by Joel Aschenbach, who usually does like science stuff, but this would be more in the history realm. But he does a really lot of interesting stuff. He has his own little blog on the Post that's pretty
interesting. Well, he's been with them a long time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Long-established Post writer.
Yeah, good writer. You know, definitely people can check it out if they want something. If they're into the science things, he's got a book out that's some, I forget what it's called, but it's all science related. Anyway, the article comes out that points out that today is the 200th anniversary to the day of the British burning Washington, D.C.
Yep.
So that has all the things that involve us, right? We're in the Washington, D.C. area. We've got the Atlantic Voice podcast, which involves a transatlantic thing. We've got British. We've got American. So I felt like we had to throw this into the podcast today. So
why don't you give people, because I obviously do not have any facts in this instance, just give people a very quick outline about what today the actual incident is. And then I'm going to come strong with my takes as to this incident. And you might be surprised to hear where I am when we discuss this.
Really? Okay, we'll see about that. Anyway, so, of course, it being 200 years ago, it was in 1814. If you could guess, that's part of the War of 1812. The War of 1812 having started in 1812, but not being confined to 1812.
Okay.
In fact, I think the deal with it was, in terms of the progress on the British side, is at the beginning of it, they were still tied up in all this Napoleonic stuff.
Yeah, all that rumbled on through 1815.
Yeah,
I mean, Napoleon was everywhere. He was like a one man because...
But by this time, by 1814, I think pretty much it was wrapping up. Like, I think Napoleon had sort of conceded, and there might have been some things left over because the troops on the British side in this particular battle were out of that conflict.
Okay.
Like, so in the first wave, it's kind of like you said about the revolution, the American Revolution, you guys sent your second tier people. It was lots of backups.
Second team,
you know, like and at the beginning. But by this time, more heavy people to bear. So here we are in the middle of the War of 1812, which was started basically the Americans pick a fight, which I was trying to analogize it to being like sort of a teenager. Like, but it doesn't quite work because it's not like we were under the auspices of our parents anymore. We'd already gotten past the revolution, but it was still a little bit of a, like, you're being a jerk to us. Cause the British were grabbing American, called impressing the sailors on a British, on American seagoing vessels. They would grab the soldiers and they'd say, hey, you're now, we drafted you into our team and come help us fight Napoleon.
But to work with your analogy there, this is not a teenager striking out at their parents, but this is more like you're in your 20s, you're living away from home. And yet when you see your parents in the holiday season,
there ends up
being a bit of back and forth because, you know, Dad, you really need to give me the remote control. I don't understand why we're watching this.
Yeah, you were deferential up to a point and suddenly you're like, hey, you know what?
I'm an adult now.
Yeah,
you know something? I'm leaving
to
go to the
credit.
Pub. I will be back for Christmas lunch.
So the Americans declare war against the British in 1812. And as the article points out, they were wholly unprepared for this actual event. It was one of those ones where, and I think the war was, President Madison at the time was considered a little bit of a folly of his. It was between, I mentioned the impressing of the sailors, and also there was some arguments going on around the fact that the British now through Canada were backing certain Native American tribes in terms of, like, you know, making life difficult on a trade basis and things like that. But it's not like what you'd think of nowadays with an out and out act of aggression.
But as a 20-year-old, to hammer home that analogy, when you're in your 20s, your behavior is kind of set. And so I find it fascinating that the War of 1812, as it says clearly in the article, this was a war that America was totally unprepared for.
Exactly right.
That behavior does not seem to change over the years. Vietnam, it didn't seem like we were really prepared.
Oh, well, but no, at that point you had a military. Invading, when we say unprepared
Iraq,
we didn't even have a
really
real,
prepared.
We didn't even really have a standing army or anything like this at that point. It's almost
like being drunk and picking a fight. That's what it seems like a little bit.
Well, and the funny thing is, too, it's not like nowadays, if you declared a war now, you'd go over and fight with it. I'm declaring a war upon you. I'll be over there. Yeah. just wait a minute. I'm going to be there. I'm declaring war on you. Here we declare a war, and we fight it all over here.
Let me say this. Remember a couple of episodes ago when I challenged people who were critical of the show to come on down to the show?
Mm-hmm.
That's what this is like. This is America saying to Britain, come on over here and we'll fight you.
That's right. I declare war on you.
But we are unprepared to fight you.
Meet me in my backyard. Although I guess the British were already in the backyard, so that's a little bit, because at that point you're still an empire, you're all over the place, so we don't really have to go to England to have a war, or go to Great Britain to have a war with you there. So
that's
at this
one
point,
of the nice things about taking on an empire is that your travel costs are immediately cut because they're already there.
Yeah. So at this point, a bunch of things have gone on, a lot of stuff up around the Great Lakes, and at this now you've got these groups of British, I think they're mostly naval forces. They're coming up the Patuxent River, which is runs east of Washington from south of it to north. So it's like off to the right side of
Chesapeake Bay.
Yeah.
Any of you that listened to our asteroid hidden sea episode from a while ago, it's the same area.
Basically, yeah. And so they come up river and we know it's going on there. It's not like you have like radar or, you know, whatever sort of tracking, but people are scouts in there and they're saying, well, what are the British going to do? And the thought at the time, particularly from the Secretary of War, John Armstrong in the United States, he says, well, surely they're not coming to Washington, D.C., because even though Washington, D.C. is the capital already at this point, there's nobody here. Like, it's just barely been built. You know, it's a few buildings with big spaces between them. There's something like 8,000 people who live in Washington, D.C. They're like, they're coming to Baltimore, because at this point, Baltimore is much more of a useful city, strategically valuable in terms of its resources and things you can grab there, you know,
ships,
cutting off trade, all
ports,
that sort of stuff in a war sense. But turns out they head up there and they make a left turn over towards Washington. So now they're coming to Washington. And so we scramble around to send a bunch of people out there and effectively get butts kicked.
Yeah.
There's one group, like the main group of people goes out there is headed up by a guy in America named Winder, who's like a lawyer by day, occasionally military, but you know, he's not really a military school type of guy. His whole group, just total mess, you know, like, and there's a smaller group led by a guy named Barney, I think, who puts up a sort of more heroic fight. But at the end of the day,
I want to ask a historical question, because this whole period of history is like a massive blind spot to me.
Yeah, well, it's a blind spot for Americans as well. Yeah. So that's why I don't feel bad giving this whole description, because I imagine out there the percentage of people who actually have heard this before being like, oh, Eric, you're telling us things we know already is probably pretty small.
What did Britain hope to achieve? Were we trying to retake America after the War of Independence? I mean, that's the thing. I don't think
retake America proper, but realize at this point the continent's not exactly – we haven't really filled it out to be the full-on United States.
So you just want to grab your bits. Yeah.
You guys are still running Canada, and so you've got pieces up there. And I think it's more about an overall global balance of power and just sort of, okay, listen, you guys won that one. You can have your colonies, you know.
Well, ultimately, we didn't hope to achieve
anything. We're still the bosses around the world.
We were just coming down for the fight that we'd been challenged to.
Maybe.
I mean, that might be it, because, again, even though it does seem that we won – this segment of it, I'm sitting here now, and unfortunately, it's your country, not mine.
Yeah.
So I don't think there are any long-term benefits for us coming 3,000 miles, clearly kicking some ass. I don't know. This is why history kind of sucks sometimes, because it doesn't really make a lot of sense. History should be more like Risk, where clearly you win this battle, so you get all of this.
Yeah, and there's certainly a possibility. I think, you know, I don't think they would have taken off the main thing, but there's a lot of – it's like Risk when there aren't when you start and you're putting, there weren't necessarily, everything wasn't occupied at that point. And that's why I'm sure, like, I love the fact that they were, the British were aligning themselves with Native American as if they were so sympathetic to the natives of various countries that they were now going to support them in their establishment of a nation. It was really about, well, listen, can they take Canada and end up taking the whole American West? You know, that I'm sure that was on their mind.
So the big moment in this war is ultimately what, and when we record, what today is
well, it, this the greatest, the big moment really is Baltimore that comes afterwards. In terms of the history of the war, that's where the Star Spangled Banner gets written. That's, you know, that's the battle that ultimately, I was just sort of build up to that.
Spoilers.
Despite the fact that the United States does very poorly in the Washington part, 3 weeks later, they win in Baltimore, and that kind of changes things around. And by 1815, it's wrapped up. We win the Battle of New Orleans, and that's kind of – that's it. And actually, at the end of the day, everybody signs pieces of paper that say – status quo, like no new territories anywhere else. I think probably the British agreed not to steal our sailors anymore, but it's not really a big shift in anything.
But this event that we're talking about is obviously the burning of the White House.
Right, right. So this is a big deal.
Moment. Yeah.
Because as it, you know, like even though it had no strategic importance, I'm sure in terms of symbolic importance, they thought, wow, we'll slap these guys around by burning down this wonderful new capital that they've only built in the past 25, 30 years or whatever it is. So they come in, so they head right in, and this is a story like Dolly Madison, who she grabs the, she has them grab the portrait of Washington. I forget who did the portrait, but it's a big oil painting, and they break the frame and roll it up and take it with them so it's not destroyed, but they don't seem to take too much else with them. And they burn, the British burn,
I mean, we got the building, like, don't
well,
we?
Well, not only that, but the Capitol, the House and Senate chambers, the Supreme Court, Treasury. Apparently, they did not burn the Patent Office because they were somebody convinced them that that was really private property. In other words, all the patents that were in there, because for all this sort of, it sounds like looting and things, most reports say there was very little of like the traditional stealing private property or burning people's private houses.
Very civilized.
Although I've read some other things that said that was in exchange for payments. Basically, you would come to your house and say, listen, you pay us this much, I won't burn down your house kind of thing. But apparently at the patent office, because the patent office collects all of these things that show people's private rights and their inventions and things, somebody supposedly convinced them, it's really not nice of you to burn this because it's not really hurting the government. It's hurting all the
hurting
people.
Hurting the individuals.
Maybe hurting all the individuals who own the patents kind of thing. It's one of the first battles that, before we get to the burning type of stuff, that one of the battles, Madison goes out there. Like it's not, this, you know, nowadays, you know, the notion that the president's going to go to battle, he heads on out there almost right into their lines. British are firing rockets. I mean, there were rockets in this war.
Well, but kind of crap rockets.
Yeah, yeah, they're junk. Apparently, it was an outgrowth of the fights you guys were having with the Indian Peninsula. I don't know what you call it. Wouldn't be.
You mean Native American?
No. Like
India. Oh, India. Yeah,
which would have had a different name. Or you know, the way they're described, the wars aren't like the Indian
Northwest Passage. Like
the,
I think
it has some funny different name. But they're having these battles, and apparently, undoubtedly, because gunpowder makes its way from China into India, they had rockets, and the British. It even had a name. I had it up here at some point.
So again, to confirm, it was the British that burned the White House.
That's right.
Because again, it's fascinating. I don't remember.
They first had a meal. There was a meal left behind because there was a plan to have dinner at 3. They sat down and they ate all the wonderful food that had been left out for them, and then they burned it down.
So it wasn't – because I must confess, historically, and again, I tend to side with the Henry Ford school of thought that history is bunk. I didn't know any of this.
Right.
Anytime something – I watched White House Down the other week, the movie with Channing Tatum, and there is a scene where he's looking at the picture and then he and Jamie Foxx decide to save the White House. Even watching that movie, which is not a great movie, for some reason in my mind I thought it was like Spain or Mexico.
Oh, really?
I never even knew it was Britain that came all this way. Because back in England, because when you grow up in Britain.
Yeah, no, it's not going to be high on your guys' list of things. No, but it is especially coming out of the Napoleon stuff. Well, I mean, that's going to be the one that you guys
talk about. That's what it is. It's actually quite an impressive victory to say yes. We invaded Washington, D.C. and burned down the White House. But it does get dwarfed by the fact that, you know, we're in the middle of defeating Napoleon all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like an impressive win. You know, it's like beating your local rival at something But ultimately, the importance of that is dwarfed by the fact that you're busy beating the teams at the top of the league.
Right.
I don't even know if that's a good example.
So burn all this stuff down.
Not very good.
James Madison and his crew basically at that point go, maybe not good for me to be here. So he turns around, goes back the opposite way. He actually flees through Northern Virginia. He stays overnight in McLean, Virginia, which is like the Tysons area basically now.
Did some shopping
and
then
he ends up. He ends up going across the river and into Maryland. And then I think they're back in the city in 3 days. Like, it is not like it's not like the British burned it and occupied it. They burned it and split.
Yeah.
Like, they were like, we did our job.
Because there's nothing else there to do, and you're not looking to take over.
Yeah. And that's why I'm sure the thought there was,
it's really just a bit of vandalism, frankly.
Exactly.
You're just running through town,
I will say that there was a piece of me that thought,
and it's sort of like, you challenge us to a fight, then this is what's going to happen to you.
Is it sort of like terrorism? It's not exactly terrorism in the sense that it was part of a battling force, and the targets were purely governmental. You know, it's not like bombing a subway kind of thing. And yet, its importance was symbolic more than it was strategic. Like, it was not like a typical war action where you're like, oh, what I'm trying to do is do this and cut these things off. It's much more symbolic. So it's the wrong analogy, but it's, you can see that.
When I watched the movie White House Down, at first you think it's terrorism, but really they're nicking money.
Then
it ends up being trying to take over the government.
That's not really analogous to this, but.
Well, it is analogous because it's the same sort of event. Whatever. No. Frankly, if you'd had Channing Tatum and Jamie Foxx and rebooted the movie to 1814, then you might have really been onto something. Although the helicopters, they were rockets, but the helicopters and machine guns might have been out.
They could make a movie out of this, actually.
Yeah, White House. White House Burned Down.
White House Down 1.
Oh.
Like, it's like a prequel.
A reboot.
Exactly. But they, so they come back and they get back in action. And so, like I said, then what happens is, in fact, the British go back to their boats. They head on out. They actually apparently took a lot more off at Alexandria, Virginia, because at that point,
that's
a bigger bustling commerce area, and they grab a bunch of boats there. They head up to Baltimore, try the same thing. That's where you get Francis Scott Key, and the other folks are in prison, and they're looking out their window. And by the end of, what is it, Fort McHenry.
Yeah, so Fort Stevens. No, Fort Stevens from the Civil War. Because on my other show, I went to a Civil War reenactment.
Yeah.
Although I do want to say this. You made a comment briefly about James Madison and presidents at the war.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even when I went to the Civil War reenactment, and again, not to promote my other show for a few moments, but one of the reenactments that they had, this was the Battle of Fort Stevens, which was a Civil War battle. They actually have a Lincoln impersonator come and give a speech to the troops, because that's what happened before the battle. He went to the fort and sort of gave a pregame pep talk. You know, like men, you know.
But at that point, you could
try and catch them offside.
You could safely keep yourself out of range
of
the other
Ronaldo
side.
Don't let Ronaldo run riot. And then he sort of goes off. So,
So that's what they do. And then ultimately, like I said, the United States wins Baltimore. Everything sort of. So that's why the battle in Baltimore is a bigger deal.
Can I ask, though?
In terms of strategy, anyway.
This was an article on the front page of the Washington Post today on the day of recording.
Mm-hmm.
And now I know that I don't know anything about history, but I'm surprised we don't, because it's so important, especially for this particular geographic area from which we broadcast. I'm surprised there's not more of a parade or anything, because it does sound like this is a big deal. I mean, in the same way that, I mean, England have a whole holiday. I know we've talked many times about Guy Fawkes Night, about the guy who tried to blow up Parliament and failed. Your main building, we just came running riot, trashed everything, paintings, whole nine yards, and then we left town. And yet, realistically, I mean, I've lived here many, many years. I didn't know anything about this.
I imagine it has something to do with, in the long run, we end up, you know, we're still more in common with the British than anything else. And so it's still a fight between you and your dad. You
know,
it's not between some crazy person so that you can build up a life. You know, this is what it is. So you have that fight with your dad in your 20s, but then when you get into your 30s or 40s, you reestablish those ties. Fine, we don't necessarily get along, but we're adults now, and we're close friends. Listen, you're still family. Like, that's what you're saying.
That.
And so to some extent it fades away. But the real important thing there, and ultimately this is what's interesting when you say that, because while it hasn't been turned into a thing for parades, it was a huge turning point culturally. Like, even if strategically it wasn't an important part of that war, culturally it was huge because it was after that that it became a rallying cry. In fact, the article makes a big talk about the last section of the article, which you probably didn't get to because I only gave it to you at the last minute, is about how we then spun it. That while in a strictly warfare sense, it was a huge fiasco on the American side in that they totally didn't have any defenses ready. They got their butts kicked. It was then turned into, like, basically, like you said, an act of vandalism. Like, that was the spin out there. And so just like – and this is what made me think actually originally about the terrorism analogy is that it became a rallying cry for unity amongst America. And, like, you know, at this point, although we'd had done the Revolutionary War, it was still really a bundle of colonies. And this had a really large part – the notion that your capital, your national capital that you were just in the process of building gets burned down by these folks. What normally happens, what everybody goes, hey, they can't do that to us. You know, that's our capital kind of thing. And suddenly you get a rallying around a national spirit because of the fact that it's spun out there around the whole world. In fact, I think their publicity of what this was, like where they spun it as this act of vandalism, makes its way into Europe and make all this sort of approach to it.
I'm going to make a strong statement right here. Britain messed up.
Right.
Instead of trashing the White House and just leaving, if we'd hung around, we might still be in charge. Well, using the logic that when you invade countries, you grab their capital and then you're running things.
If it was like today, but I think at that point, the capital just happened to be the collection of buildings. Okay, I mean, it's not like you really took over the arms of government because left. You know?
That's
true. Like nowadays, what you would do is you'd move in and you'd commandeer the ministries and all the departments and things like that, and you just make them serve your purpose. So, like, if the Department of War, or, you know, or state, or all stays there. Now you come in and you basically say, "You guys report to me now." That works. But if basically everybody leaves, they all just set up in Philadelphia or something like that again, and they start from scratch. So that was sort of an interesting aspect that where it turns into this sort of rallying cry around which, and it started what they called in a very cheesy sort of name, the era of good feelings, which was like a lack of partisanship. It was almost like they were trying to abolish a party system that involved, in fact, I think the Federalist Party dies coming out of this, and so now we have the what's ultimately they call it Democratic Republican Party. That's a Republican Party, and then somehow we split up, and we end up with Democrats.
All right,
Republicans
so again. The era of what?
Good feelings.
All right, because I'm at this moment I'm now trademarking
Benjamin Russell in the Boston Federalist newspaper, right. Columbian Sentinel.
I am now trademarking the White House Down prequel idea. Uh-huh. So if anyone makes that move in the next 3 years, you owe us some money.
You have to file for trademark.
Whatever. I'm verbally filing anyway. Mm-hmm. This era of good feelings, that may be the working title, but that's going out the window. Mm-hmm. Right now, our movie is White House Down Begins.
White House Down Begins.
Because that's sort of the prequel. Like Batman Begins.
Yeah, but it didn't really lead into the other White House Down.
Well, yeah, it does.
But White House Down, the first generation.
We could do White House Down first generation, like a Star Trek thing.
Degrassi High, the next generation.
Oh, no, okay, yeah, I'll give you that.
But it's the opposite direction.
All right, no, we can do that.
So, anything else interesting at that? I'm trying to remember. Oh, apparently one of the things that put out the fires is there was a big storm.
Okay.
Like, and it was in some things in the paper, like at the time, people would call it a tornado or a hurricane. And people don't, you know, at that point you didn't have the weather report to really say, oh, no, that was a hurricane. It's like this. All right. So this article speculates that it's a derecho, which people don't know what a derecho is. One swept through Washington, D.C.
a couple years ago. It was like this wall-type storm
that kind of swept through here.
A lot of this stuff. You know, without CNN, you really can't corroborate any of this stuff.
Exactly.
You know.
One of the houses that Madison stayed at is still kept up by, like, it's still a house now, and the owners of it, like, are really fastidious about keeping it up as a historical monument. Like, they dress up occasionally, invite people in and stuff like that. Sandy Heiler owns this house that Madison was staying at.
I think it's a shame. If this had happened at a different time of the year, like in the winter, you could have turned it into a big festival and had bonfires and stuff, but no one really wants to sit outside in a hot cookout in the middle of August.
That's true.
So that's, yeah, okay.
That, I mean, that is the really the interesting part, is that, that it didn't turn into, like, a thing. It just...
It's not a thing anyway.
It seeped into the culture without being an event.
Again, I only know about it from the Channing Tatum movie.
I wonder if I wonder if it's because of what happened with the Star-Spangled Banner. The 3 weeks later, we have the Genesis. So when we all tell the story of the 1812 and the big battle, it's that. And, like, you wouldn't tell the story three weeks beforehand.
The White House getting burned
down.
There's
only so many stories that are going to come out of the War of 1812.
And the White House down is... The White House down. The White House being burned down. Or White House burned down. That's the name of our movie.
There you go.
That's just sort of backstory to, and then we won at Baltimore and the Star-Spangled Banner was born. Do you know what I mean? It's just sort of gets, it is its preface. And really, it's kind of, to me, it's a bigger deal than that.
Yeah.
Like, I would imagine in England, if someone had rolled through and completely, you know, if the Germans had bombed Buckingham Palace in the Blitz, you would still read about that. Like, it's a big deal. Like, and where the Queen lived got destroyed. And yet here, it's like, the White House got burned down.
Yeah.
Again, I learned about it from a movie.
The other thing is we had the Civil War after that, and Civil War is so much bigger deal for the nation. True. That becomes a big, kind of jumps on top of it. But in any event, listen, ultimately, I forgive you, Zeph.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, enough about that. Well.
So, there you go. Yeah.
Next piece of war, I don't know if you want to tell the story, you know, we have warned the world.
Yes.
The danger of asteroids.
Yeah. Well, that's been a very big topic on the show here.
You know,
I've been
sounding the clarion call to the world that we should be concerned about this and developing plans or defenses. And I haven't really heard a lot about that, so I don't know if people are working on that. But it turns out there's even something more dangerous in space coming after us.
Hit us with it.
It's the solar storms, or what they call the coronal mass ejections, which is CMEs for short.
Yeah.
Which is basically like huge plumes of plasma, they say. It's basically energy and neutrons.
Basically the sun farting is what it is.
Kind of. Like big storms. They actually say it's linked to solar flares, but it's not necessarily, like, it's not exactly the same thing. Like, when solar flares happen, that's when this sort of thing happens. But it's, you know, the sun, we see it's a nice little smooth ball out there.
Yep.
It's bright and stuff like that. But it's a real cauldron of stuff, and it shoots out these waves of energy and plasma. And it's what causes the northern lights. Like, so when these waves come, they're always coming off at some level. But when they hit the Earth, in fact, our magnetic It's the electromagnetic
pulse
properties of meaning the Earth like deflects it.
Yeah,
That's why all the storms are in going pretty well here. What's the stuff at night you see that I just said already?
Aurora Borealis.
Yeah. So northern those are lights. Those are up in the northern hemisphere, up at the poles, because it's pushing all of the magnetic energy and debris off to the ends. And so when you get big storms like this and it hits the United States or America or the world, I should say, you could actually get that aurora borealis all over the Earth. And it's very dangerous.
The consequences could be devastating for commerce, transportation, agriculture, and food stocks, fuel and water supplies, human health and medical facilities.
You're jumping to like...
Well, no, I'm trying to let the listener know, because they're sitting there going, this is these guys banging on about another thing from space.
Right.
What I'm saying is, this is potentially a civilization affecting event.
But you've leapt to like the consequence without explaining what's actually going to... what would happen.
Well, I'm now going to explain how it would happen.
All right. Zeph does science.
All right. Anyone who's seen the movies Armageddon and Deep Impact, that's what happens when asteroids attack.
Yeah.
All right. If you've seen the James Bond movie GoldenEye, where they detonate the nuclear bomb in the atmosphere and the planes crash into the satellite dish.
Electromagnetic pulse.
That's similar in that all your stuff is affected, but you're not actually physically hit by like a brick.
Right.
Or the Steven Seagal movie Under Siege 2, which in my opinion is actually the most superior of the Under Siege movies. The one where he's on the train.
Yeah, sure.
That the terrorists are holding the world hostage by threatening to create an electromagnetic pulse that would basically destroy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
While I understand that this cloud of plasma is not the same in terms of what it does, in terms of how it operates, the effects are just as devastating.
Right.
Enough that both Pierce Brosnan and Steven Seagal had to be utilized to defeat it.
Yeah, well, I think the way it works is it's such a wave of electromagnetic energy and electrons and protons that
But it doesn't kill you, it just kills everything
else. Well, it messes with circuits. Anything that's electrical, just like...
would send us back to the Stone Age.
Did you do this in Britain where you would you take a magnet and you run it over a wire, you can create electricity?
Someone else probably did it, yeah. I wasn't much of a student. I probably watched someone else.
Yeah. So anyway,
the answer is yes, but indirectly.
Magnetic forces can move the electrons. I mean, that's how we take turbines and we turn them into electricity. Like they turn a bunch of magnets inside of the wire coils that generates electricity in the coils, et cetera. So this wave of stuff can throw electricity through circuits like we don't want it to happen and fry stuff out.
This is what concerns me about
basically
this,
blow it. Like, so basically, the ultimate consequence of this thing, and the reason they say it could have all those devastating consequences, it could burn out like all of the electricity generation in the
world. Just destroys it. Yeah,
like just every transformer everywhere gets fried because this isn't running. And there's no way, like it's one thing when you burn out a transformer in one location, you go back get the replacement parts. There's no way you could rebuild from this
because
for
everything
quite a long time.
Yeah.
So, basically the world didn't have electricity, or a lot of the world didn't have electricity.
Well, no, it would destroy everything.
Yeah. First of all, it's also going to burn out your cars because they're all electronic now and things like that. But all the systems we have, all the internet, all the, like, keeping control of food, growing food, shipping food, trade, commerce, blammo.
Yeah.
I think they estimated it. They said, okay, so I should say, we should say.
This show would be forced off the air. That's how serious it is.
We could do it from a soapbox. Like people would all have to gather around us and we could just stand up on stage and give it.
But that would really
shrink the audience down.
That's how dangerous this is. Well, I don't know if it would shrink the audience. I might actually grow the audience.
But this is what was concerning to me. We'd have less competition.
We both found this article in the paper.
Yeah, this was another Washington Post article from its Capital Weather Gang.
Yeah. Which is sort of like when you join the Washington Post, you want to do sports or politics. But really, when you're starting up, you get assigned to the weather desk. That's the reality.
No, the Capital Weather Gang was a bunch of people who they weren't really with the paper originally. They're like,
that's what I'm saying.
They're amateur meteorologists.
They're not even employees.
Maybe they're professional meteorologists.
So on the level that the paper were paying attention to this, it's quite a ways down.
I got
to
tell you.
To me, this is front page news, and let me tell you why. The chances of Earth being destroyed by an asteroid is 300 to 1.
Within what time frame?
I didn't look at that. I'm just telling you. There's a 300 to 1 chance that we're going to get killed by an asteroid. So when the dinosaurs were wiped out, that was a 300 to 1 shot. The dinosaurs...
This is why you shouldn't gamble.
The dinosaurs had sort of hit. They got their pick six correct. Bang, 300 to 1. The chances of one of these storms coming, solar storms, and wiping us out, 1 in 10.
Yeah.
That's a lot less than asteroids. That's my point. This could happen at any time.
So in order to really actually evaluate odds, you need a time frame. Because if it's 1 in 10 per day, then it's going to happen sometime in the next couple of weeks.
I understand here that you're like, oh, well, you know, you got... 1 in 10 or 1 in 3. The bottom line is there's more chance of the solar storm.
Anyway, I happen to know that the 1 in 10 odds is within the next 10 years.
Still.
Right, that's high.
Okay.
I don't have any idea what the 1 in 300 is, if that's within a 100-year span or within a, you know, what kind of time frame it is.
Yeah, I understand that.
So, anyway.
The solar storm is more dangerous than asteroids.
So what led to the discussion about all this stuff is, in fact, in 2012, there was a huge solar storm that we missed by 1 week, basically.
Yeah.
If it had happened 1 week earlier, it would have covered the Earth and this stuff and all these things, these dire doom and gloom predictions.
So actually, it's not even 1 in 10. It's 1 in 2.
What? Why is it?
Because if it had come the other way, it went one way. But that's what I'm saying.
So nobody listened to that.
Okay.
That doesn't make any
the
sense.
The odds are high that we could get wiped out by this. So what's the plan to defend us?
Well, so first of all, some more statistics on the events. Basically, the estimate was if that one had hit us, which, by the way, that was a unusually large storm. So when they talk about this 1 in 10 chance, I don't think it's necessarily that big a storm, but it's certainly a 1 in 10 chance of a significant impact of event hitting us. But the last one, they compare this one. There's a thing called the Carrington Solar Storm of 1859, if you can believe it. And at that point, you know, we didn't have a lot of electricity, but this storm was so bad that it caused...
You just got your White House back.
Exactly. That's right. It caused, like, telegraph lines to spark. Just random lines were so influenced by the just sparking and catching on fire. But that's pretty much it, because we didn't have a lot of electrical stuff going on there. They estimated that if this one that had just happened in 2012 had hit us, it would have been $2 trillion in economic impact, which is basically 20 times the cost of Hurricane Katrina. So I imagine actually also probably would matter which way the Earth happened to be facing at the time. You know, like if it – I don't know how long these things last.
Yeah, that's what's so confusing.
Let's say if it's a half an hour type of thing, you know, to do this stuff. But what's interesting, so it has all this stuff and people have been talking about we need to do things. I was reading an article from Popular Mechanics that talked about that it's not all that hard to build in precautionary measures. Like so, for example, you can apparently build in circuits – onto all the transformers in the world that would basically cut them off from the system in the event this was happening.
All right,
so they wouldn't get fried. You might like have to turn off the electricity for a while.
So the defense isn't, for example, like when you get attacked by asteroids, the only way to defend it is to destroy the asteroid rather than, you know, like in Armageddon.
Destroy them or catch them or steer them or something like that.
We've got to send Bruce Willis up there.
Right.
There's no other way.
No, you can't really shield the Earth from this.
Whereas one of the better things about being attacked by the storm is if we just build new stuff, then we're going to be fine. Right. It will just wash by.
Yeah, I will say, you know, there was
because I actually did have an idea.
Storm a few years ago. I forget what year they said, but they actually the airlines because the most just because of the way the magnetic. The world
oh, the
works.
Planes crashed.
Well, this is what happened in Golden. This is something that actually happened. The airlines rerouted their plane flights to not go over the North Pole areas, because there was an exposure of radiation from this. So that you would have some radiation problems from this, but it's not wiping people out. But you know, could cause more cancers or something.
Yeah,
like
or
that.
Or you land and you've suddenly got a third arm or something.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, not suddenly, but you know, eventually,
but over time, you grow a third arm.
But so they had the one thing was that they apparently you could develop things that would do this, and so that what they were saying the real problem here at this point is not that there's nothing to do. It's that. Getting people to do it because it's pretty costly to introduce these safety systems. And apparently, like a number of years ago, United States the government had a bill called the Grid Act or something, but it was supposed to give the government some power to make sure that the electrical grid would stay up in the event of any kinds of events like attacks and things like that. But of course, just like everything in Washington, you know, turned into fights, too much big government, and never got anywhere. So this is the kind of thing we have to. This is actually, I think, important that people have to come up with a plan for dealing with this. The other thing they put out there is they want to put out a bunch of basically weather buoys, like satellites.
That would have been my solution.
That run around the sun.
Yeah.
And so you can tell what's going on everywhere.
Well, but you can tell what's going on. But what I'm saying is once the storm cloud, plasma cloud is in transit, you cannot stop it. My plan is actually for stopping it.
Oh, yeah? How are you going to do that?
Have you seen the James Bond movie Die Another Day?
I'm sure I
and
have.
In that James Bond movie, again, that's a Pierce Brosnan James Bond movie, the guy has built like a huge big balloon thing in space to create a second sun. And then he turns the power into a laser beam to destroy everything.
Okay.
You can use the same technology because it's like when he opens it up, it's like a big flower opening.
Yeah.
So it's a huge, like thousands of miles across, like a huge big sort of balloon. You can just put it up there and shield it like an umbrella. It's like opening an umbrella.
Well, what if...
And I want to say something now because when
what
I
if
get...
that shield
on, no,
is
no.
not quite
hold
adequate to the task?
I want to say this. You've just laughed at me for going to Hollywood for the solution.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly, and I want to read the article here. I understand 1 in 10 chance, deadly blast, we're all in danger. NASA's solution... isn't to come up with any of these plans, but their solution is to run a competition with a first prize to see who has the best idea to defect us from storms. Well, no, I get that, but what I'm saying is I think we need to be taking things. If this storm is that bad, then government teams should be assigned to fix this. It shouldn't be some competition because, frankly,
I don't know.
I'm submitting my idea. I've just come up with the huge balloon umbrella idea. I want a shot.
I think
$30 million is the prize.
Yeah. So I think you need some governmental help for implementation. But in terms of invention, I'm not relying on the government to come up with an invention to solve this problem.
There are no other guys hidden away on
another
floor.
Like, you know what? The government doesn't build weapon systems. It relies on private enterprise to come up with cool weapon systems.
Yeah, no, but doesn't
then it buys them.
Yeah, but doesn't have a competition.
Sure does.
Well, no, but this is a competition where, like, people like us can submit our ideas.
I mean, I'm sure you could enter the competition for the next jet fighter, but normally, you know, you have it between qualified companies. I imagine, listen, they open it up, you can all enter it.
I am submitting for the $30 million prize.
It's going to be like the FA Cup. It's going to be like the FA Cup. Your entry is going to go in the early tiers, and Lockheed Martin, they're going to wait like 8 rounds into the playoffs, and then they can just start playing whoever's left.
All right, fair enough, but all I'm saying is, my idea, that's now on the table.
Okay.
For details, just check out the movie Die Another Day.
You claim you're trademarking that one too?
Well, yeah.
That'll be a patent, but you need to file for that.
Whatever. But because when the people made the James Bond movie, they just made it as entertainment. So they can't claim it as their idea for Defending Earth. But I'm now using it as a reference for our idea for Defending
Earth. There's no new ideas.
A massive space
only retreads from movies. No new ideas, just retreads from movies.
Well, again, most people only know the movies, and I've been able to just explain Washington history with movies, and I've now explained science with movies, basically James Bond films and Steven Seagal. And anyone sitting at home who's like, yeah, I'm not into science, their ears have perked up when I've said it's going to be like Under Siege 2, but don't worry, we're going to save it like Die Another Day. And that person's gone, okay, I get it. I'm not so worried about the 1 in 10 chance of us being blasted by the solar storm.
All right.
1 in 10, people.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, the ending of the article talks about, NASA online article says there's a 12% chance of Carrington-type event, meaning a big one. And
It's more than 1 in 10.
Right.
Or less.
In the next 10 years.
Thank you.
And the quote from this guy's name is Peter Riley of Predictive Science, Inc. Quote, initially, I was quite surprised the odds were so high, but the statistics appear to be correct. It's a sobering figure.
Yes. That's what I'm saying. Now, the more depressing thing about the story is now the chances of dying by asteroid is only 1 in 300. Our listeners have every right to go, you guys need to stop talking about the asteroids.
Well, you know, you got to worry about everything.
Although I actually
put it this way, we've broadened our defense of Earth against asteroids to a defense of Earth against space.
I'm going to set one of these famous choices for you. We've done this before with many things. Would you rather have the Earth be destroyed by solar storm or asteroids?
Well, destroyed, I don't really care if it's really destroyed.
What I'm saying is your regular life is changed forever. Would you rather be by solar storm or asteroids? The correct – well, give me an answer, then I'm going to give you the correct answer.
Oh, okay. I'm going to go with solar storm.
That's the wrong answer.
Oh, is that right?
You'd rather be destroyed by asteroids.
Why is that?
Destroyed by solar storm, right? You've still got like a normal life, but none of your electronics work. So it kind of sucks. It's like being a little kid.
No, you'll
– well, and if an asteroid comes and people are getting wiped out, it's like a whole new era.
Yep. In other words, you're agreeing with me.
Well, no, I would rather have the Earth be attacked by asteroids.
Why didn't you just say that's worse?
I'd rather have a new, different life
than
solar storm, where it's kind of like regular life, except you've got to walk everywhere. All the things we do on the computer, we can't do anymore. If I need you to get something before you come here, I can't just send you a text and go, hey, can you pick up some chips on the way over?
Well, you won't be able to do that with the asteroid scenario either. It'll be even worse.
Yeah, but
you're just saying you want to go to, like, totally primitive, you know, kill your neighbor version with the asteroids.
I mean, if we're gonna have a great big kerfuffle, I'd rather it completely changed everything than just sort of left you with the same sort of life, but one that sucks.
All right, that makes no sense, but I'll let you have that position. And with that, next warfare topic?
Dolphins.
Dolphins.
All right, hit them with the story, because I now have some hot takes on this one.
Well, I have to do all the facts again. You found
this. All right,
story.
I'll do it.
Yeah.
The Ukraine are apparently demanding the return of combat dolphins.
This article's getting a little bit old now. But
doesn't matter. Yeah. I don't think dolphins have a sense of time.
So this comes from them taking Crimea, because when that part is done already. Like, we're in that whole revolution in Ukraine, but before that, they grabbed Crimea.
Russia grabbed Crimea, and in the process, they basically took control.
They picked up a lot of bases and stuff, including these dolphins.
Including a dolphin base, and the dolphins were trained to carry out military tasks. Now, Ukraine are demanding that they give the dolphins back.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where this fits in the list of other things that they want back, but clearly...
Well, apparently they returned, like, actual military equipment they mostly gave back. Like, there was a whole division of things. Basically, the soldiers that were there in the Crimea, you could get the choice. You can surrender or you can defect over to the Russian
side.
Now,
if you don't know what a combat dolphin is, Combat Dolphin is a dolphin that is trained to be dropped from a helicopter.
What?
It's, I'm looking at the picture of the dolphin here. It says one of Ukraine's combat dolphins trained to be dropped from helicopters to find underwater mines. The dolphins were part of a secret program that trained sea mammals to carry out military tasks.
Yeah, there's only two bases that do that. You know where the other one is?
The dolphins are still being held at an aquarium, but the aquarium is now basically, you know, it's being held by the Russians. So the Ukrainians, they're like, look, we've trained these dolphins. We want them back.
Yeah, it's like any other military equipment.
Yeah. They also had sea lions, apparently.
No, I think that's insane.
Oh, is that America has?
Yeah, that's
America
what I was about to say. So there's two. There's only two places that are doing well. Two known. Places
now I want to say
it's
normally historically
Crimea and
so historically in the arms race, America used to come up with the good stuff, and then Russia would make sort of like cheap knockoffs. Like their spaceships were kind of crap versions of Apollo, or their Concorde was like a crap version of the proper Concorde. But actually, this is one area where our Russian cousins are in front of us.
No.
Because they went with dolphins, and the West went with sea lions.
You have the article in front of you, and you're getting it wrong.
Oh, I am?
First of all, it's not a Russian program. It's a Ukrainian program.
Whatever. They're all Russian. They all speak that way, don't they?
No.
I mean, that's the trouble.
It was Russian, and then they gave up on it, and then they switched over. But the American includes dolphins and see, look right there.
And it says
where 75 dolphins are trained in San Diego, along with sea lions.
Okay, apparently the Ukrainians had also no. The Russians had actually trained dolphins and then attempted to sell them to Iran. Is this an April Fool's article? Because all this sounds vaguely ridiculous to me.
It is the way you're reading it. There are reports.
Iran doesn't even have an ocean.
2002.
All right, let me. This is where I am with this story. And I'm going to take... Now, normally, long-time listeners of the show will know, that, and my partner will agree, I have a nasty tendency sometimes to let my opinions get in the way of the facts. But here, I'm going to lead with the facts. While I think this is an amusing story, I'm completely over these dolphins. Dolphins... Everyone thinks dolphins are like the world's smartest animals. They're not. Dolphins are stupid. Let me tell you why. How many other animals do you know that sign up for this stuff? Why would you sign up to do a job that could kill you?
Let me just hang that in the air a while. And then let's ask, do you think they volunteered for this job?
Which is my point now. Well, no, I'm being serious. We're always hearing how intelligent dolphins are. Yet they're the only animal that seems to be signing up to basically be domesticated.
But they're not.
Even if
up.
You gave dogs a chance, they would run wild.
No, they don't. What do you think bomb-sniffing dogs do?
Well, yeah, but that's because that's what I'm saying. Mm. What I'm saying is we have this image of dolphins as being super intelligent, and they talk to each other, and they've got radar, and look, they can do all these tricks and everything. And yet dolphins are continually getting roped in to do stuff that we need, like where you could get blown up. That doesn't make you very intelligent.
And giving people rides at the SeaWorld.
That's what I'm saying.
Well, listen.
They have that stupid smile.
Realize that they are taken against their will.
Like
and they may be relatively smart, but they're not that smart. And so they're eager to please and they're social and they do this.
They're not
sort
as smart
of
as like a giraffe. Giraffes, you don't see them getting captured all the time and doing stuff.
What do you mean? They're
tigers
in your zoo.
Some.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is...
And you've seen the circus before, right?
Dolphins are continually getting
tigers
caught.
Don't do things. You're in the sea and in the circus.
No, but most tigers live in the wild. Like sharks.
Most dolphins also live in the wild.
When you look at like different fish, sharks, they know because they're always eating people and being aggressive, mm-hmm. they're not getting roped up and being stuck in some pool. Mm-hmm. Dolphins and whales are always getting captured. All I'm saying is I'm tired of hearing how smart they are. They're not that smart.
I think they're very, very smart.
No, they're smart at these tasks, but overall in like just general intelligence, they're pretty stupid.
Well, in the hierarchy of animals, you can't put giraffes ahead.
Why? Why not?
Because they're not as intelligent. They can't problem solve.
But we don't know that because giraffes never get caught.
What anyway, do you mean we get caught all the time? Anything that get the ones in the zoo that you see.
I think a giraffe would be quite good because it's got that long neck. You can use it to get stuff without getting too near it.
The thing about the giraffes is they wouldn't be good at the aquatic version that the dolphin's useful because the giraffes can't. I mean, I guess they could stand on the bottom of the water and they could go into deeper water.
But you could train them to
do because their head's high enough that it'd be above the surface.
You could train a giraffe to do like bomb sniffing because he's got such a long neck. And you know like those automatic robots that they send in to check out the car? Well, you could just get a giraffe, have him sniff it out, but because he's got such a long neck.
Isn't the deal with giraffes that they can't even put, I said giraffes just like you, they can't even put their head down to the ground, so I don't think they would be a good choice.
Oh, they can't?
I don't think so. I think that's why they got to eat out of trees.
Well, no, I just thought they ate out of trees because they can get all the food that like hyenas and other animals.
I think they're evolved, so they're focused on going up, not down.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, then they can, I'm sure there's got to be some sort of military use for giraffes. There's got to be a way where that long neck is going to come in handy. I don't know, tethering blimps to it or something like that. There's got to be something. That's what I'm saying.
All right. So we have your hot take on dolphins and their unintelligence. Here's my hot take coming out of the
article. Like I said, I think they're bullshot animals. I'm tired of all this smiling and squeaking and everything. I don't think they're half as clever as either we give them credit for or they seem to think they are. That's all I'm saying. I'm tired of hearing how
smart. You can invite one on as a spite guest?
Yeah. Come on. Well, if they were that clever and they could
communicate. They'd have podcasts.
They would have something similar because a pod, that's what you call whales. They go
dolphin
pods, and they're all, yeah.
They're probably upset we're using the phrase podcast.
Even like, this picture here is a dolphin smiling, but he doesn't know that when
I believe that's a stock photo.
When he's trained.
Plus, their faces are always smiling. It's not like they can frown.
I know what? But this is kind of cool, though. They drop it from a helicopter.
Yeah, that part's a little weird.
So basically, they fly it along, drop it in the water, and then it goes down to get the underwater. Yep. I mean, that is kind of cool, but. It's cool, but also kind of moronic.
My hot take on this has nothing to do with the dolphins themselves. It really has to do with the Russians. Because if you read this article, so part of this battle is the Ukrainians saying, listen, you gotta give this stuff up. And so then the article goes on, which, by the way, we should credit it. It's out of The Guardian had this article. I forget when it was, but it was a few weeks
ago.
The Russians, however, have, as I'm quoting it, have big plans for their newest naval recruits. A source told Russian agency RII Novosti, whoever that is, back in March that with Crimea part of Russia, serious investment in dolphin preparation was now in the cards. Quote, engineers are developing new aquarium technologies for new programs to more efficiently use dolphins underwater. In other words, they go and say, our specialists have developed new devices that convert their underwater sonar to detection, blah, blah, blah. You know, Ukrainian Navy lacked funds for that.
Okay.
So
you missed that one bit, though, before I let you finish. The source says that the dolphins and seals would search for sunken military equipment.
Just dolphins.
Okay. And detect enemy divers.
Yeah.
Why don't you train sharks to do that? Because then the sharks will eat the enemy divers. The dolphin isn't. He's going to smile. You're going to swim about. You're going to get a ride. That's what I'm saying.
It's because
dolphins are just generally moronic.
The sharks, no. The sharks are really bad at finding things like that.
All right.
Plus, what are you going to have? The sharks bite the mines? Anyway.
If I'm an enemy diver trying to invade and I see a shark, I'm bricking it.
See, what you're saying is like, so.
If I see a dolphin squeaking, I'm
going
to
go. Dogs can go retreat. Like, so hunting dogs, they'll go find animals.
Okay.
You're like suggesting, well, you know, we should, because they're so willing to comply with us, they're clearly dumb.
Yes.
So we should get cats to find these things. So, because they must be smarter because they're less cooperative, right?
No, now you're just being silly. What I'm saying is there are other more violent, tougher sea animals.
The difficulty is they won't cooperate with us. So you really can't get a shark to go find the divers. Because you go to the shark and go, find the diver, and then they just bite your hand off right there on the spot.
Right. So what you're saying to me is then, I think dolphins are dumb, but you actually what you're telling me is they're not stupid, they're just diplomatic. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, kinda.
All right.
They have
I'm not sure how much street cred you get in the animal.
Back to my point, which you interrupted, which is it's another case of like we've seen lots of this Russian like, oh, we know what's going on here, and like it's this new version of their propaganda machine that's sort of laughable. I find it to be almost like they're their own satire. Like the idea that the Russians have grabbed these dolphins and now they're like, oh, we know what to do with these dolphins. We've got big plans for them. You guys can't have these back. We are all over this dolphin thing and we're gonna be taking this stuff to new heights. We'll be sending dolphins to the moon before you know it, kind of thing. And you know, it's just sort of comic. I can sort of picture like the caption on the TV show out of the Russian TV station that says, you know, dolphin leader, you know, some person up there like banging on the table about how much they know about dolphins and how they are going to solve this problem. And the Ukrainians didn't know how to properly use these dolphins, and they are going to solve the problem, and they are going to bring wonderful things to all of Mother Russia.
Department of Dolphinia.
Exactly. So that's more than I thought we could ever possibly say about the dolphins.
No, I know. I mean, but and I couldn't. And it's funny you said that there, though. I can't decide. This is a true story.
Yeah.
I mean, because I have heard of...
I mean, they're definitely there. I mean, who knows, you know, behind this all. I mean, this is like a two-pager or not.
Because doesn't the U.S. use dolphins for stuff?
And we just discussed it. San Diego, they got 75 dolphins.
No, you said that, yeah, you got 75, but you didn't say what they did.
Well, you know, some of it's going to be secret, but it's a lot of finding mines and detecting things and moving things around. I think they do...
What do the sea lions do?
That's, I don't know.
I've never seen... I mean, I've never been... There's no like...
They always struck me as pretty uncooperative.
Yeah, and they just sort of, they seem relatively lazy, Frank. They just sort of sit around sitting on rocks, don't they? What would they do?
I guess they have the advantage that they can go on land, right? So, like, the dolphins got to stay in the water. Whereas the sea lion...
Except for if he's being dropped from a helicopter.
Well, we don't want to get too distracted. We've got to figure out how do you drop them from a helicopter. Because you have to have them in water on the way, or at least wet, right? I mean, I guess they breathe air, so if you kept them moist, like in some moist towels
on the way there. You know how they use those tanks when they put out wildfires?
Yeah, yeah.
I guess you could just sort of take him up in one of them and then open the doors and drop him out.
Yeah, something like that.
No, I mean,
anyway.
So the sea lions, I'd like to know what they did.
Yeah, we'll check into that for next episode.
All right.
Last form of war.
Yes.
Football or soccer.
Soccer.
Yeah. You're doing your Grantland impression, Men in Blazers. Soccer.
Soccer.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Premier League has begun again.
Yeah.
And I am I've been reading a lot of stuff online, and I am still continually amazed at how big it's become here. Now, I've said that, I know that it's not really big in the grand scheme of things, but it's definitely sucking up a lot of media attention. And maybe it's quiet because the NFL has not started and baseball's still not quite in its postseason again. But apparently, all the ratings are way up for games.
Yeah, they were up last year, apparently. So NBC took it over, remember, so it was 2 years ago, it was on Fox channels. They had the Fox Soccer Channel. Now it's mostly on NBC Sports, although they're putting a number on a primetime broadcast or regular NBC broadcasts on, not primetime, but in the afternoon. But apparently last year the ratings were up, I don't know if it's double, but it was certainly like 50% higher than it had been with Fox. And they're showing every single game, whether some of them are online. Although I saw something, Verizon Fios, which is where we get our TV. Apparently, they're going to have all the games, so you can watch them on TV. You don't even have to go online.
So that's good.
There's going to be a whole bunch of channels where you could see all the other games.
So you could DVR it.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's pretty good.
But, the ratings are way up. I mean, of course, a lot of it, I think, has to do – they're capitalizing on the World Cup's popularity. We talked about how well that did and all the viewership. And so now NBC, with the backing of NBC instead of Fox, which – you know, Fox is not tiny, but NBC's got more clout, I think, and more people tuning in on a day-to-day basis.
I also think they're cashing in on two other things. From a purely TV perspective, what people need to understand about the time difference actually is huge.
Well, yeah.
We've said this before on the show about different things. It is European sports are perfect for America.
For a busy American, yeah.
Because you get it, it sort of fills a time of day when there's nothing else on but cartoons. So it's a winner for the TV stations. So they're already getting more viewers and ratings and commercial time than they would otherwise. But it also doesn't directly compete with domestic sports.
Yeah.
So what I mean is, if I'm a big baseball fan, I can still have my fill of this sport from another country, and I'm not making an either-or choice. And I think that's the interesting thing specifically about European soccer and, to a lesser extent, other European sports. I know Formula One's got a lot bigger. I also think, too, you know, thanks to, you know, the modern world and the internet, sports are less – we all have the ability to follow things beyond our own borders. What I'm driving at here is there is still something.
It's not so much
because I don't see this as people are into soccer. Now I know the World Cup was very popular this time around, but I don't suddenly see this as And I know as a soccer guy, American soccer fans can listen to this and start calling me a traitor and all this kind of thing, because I know they're always taking the position that soccer is the next big thing. I don't think that this is as much a reflection of soccer. What I see this as, you know, it's like a whole new set of what I mean is, I think it goes beyond just the game itself. Do you know what I mean? It's like we're suddenly being exposed. It's like suddenly seeing a French movie for the first time. Maybe that's a bad example. Or like, you know, foreign TV. I know. I'm being dead serious. I'm not explaining myself very well. Obviously, you have to like soccer to watch it. But I noticed NBC, they don't just sell soccer. They sell pick a team, tribalism.
There we go. So now
look at this culture.
You're getting to the topic that I wanted to talk about here, which is...
Well, you didn't tell me that. I would have just led you there to start.
Well, it's part of our war thing.
Don't behave like a dolphin. Be more assertive.
Oh, please.
Don't just be led around by your captor. Are you a man or a dolphin?
The reason it has become popular is because of the narrative, as they say. It's the story that goes behind this stuff. And this is why I was going to fit it into the war thing. We don't need to talk at all about what's going on all this and whether it's getting better publicity. I'm going to first advocate for it. I'm going to say the things that you said, which are, it's convenient. I mean, assuming you don't have, you know, kids' youth soccer games to go in the morning, you can pop in there. It's only 2 hours. The games are always 2 hours. They're no more, no less, because we don't have to deal with an overtime to settle everything. Sure. We can say, hey, it's a draw. That's fine. You can get it with your cup of coffee. The games start, you know, on the East Coast, they start as early as like 8 o'clock in the morning on Saturdays. And if you're out West, boy, you know, you just roll out of bed at 6 o'clock. You can watch this stuff. And,
yeah. And then the games get on with your day.
Yeah, get on with your day.
Yeah.
In fact, when they had the, you know, they played a lot of exhibition games in the United States. All these English teams were touring around doing that Guinness Cup thing and stuff like that. And I went to watch a couple games. And by the way, if you watch those things and somebody was like, well, that's not so exciting, realize that that was a tier below the regular stuff you're going to see.
Yeah, it's a preseason
game. It was definitely preseason type style. But B, I was really annoyed that it was in the afternoon, like, or evening. Some of the games, I was like,
getting in the way of my day.
Exactly. I was like, it's so much nicer when I just watched it while I read the newspaper and then I went on with my day. Now you're asking me to watch this at 3 to 5. I got things I want to do, you know. I didn't watch very much preseason for both of those reasons. But in any event, great now. It's in the season. We got 38 games. It's nice and encapsulated, and there's other things going on.
100,000 people went to see one of those preseason games.
Yeah, up in University of Michigan. Yeah.
My mind boggles at that.
They used to have that in the olden days in England, you know, back before you had seated stands.
No,
and
I know,
all that stuff.
But what I'm saying is, this is in another country for a game that doesn't mean anything.
Right. Well, that seemed to me almost like gimmicky, like people wanted to go because it would be the event of 100,000. So, in any event, we get past this. I advocate it. Everybody should watch it. Now, you have to pick a team. If you haven't picked a team yet, you have to pick a team.
Yeah.
And this is where the war piece comes up. Okay. And this is how it fits in the narrative, is that once you pick a team, it's now – you care what happens, the drama of who you get transferred in, the rivalries, all the things that go along with it. Now you've picked a role in the show, so to speak, a character to follow, and then you can follow as things go on and things happen over the course of the season. And that's the war piece. Once you pick a team, it's fun, you know, like you're following all this sort of stuff. But
I want to show you how the notion, though, and I do think back in England, they're very aware now that their product is very much international. We haven't spoken about my mother for the longest time on this show, so I'm going to give my mother...
At least 2 weeks.
I'm going to give my dear old mother a shout out. She emailed me to have me buy for her a shirt for the team I support back in England. Then stop and think about that for a moment. Right. She's emailing me 3,000 miles away in another country to buy for her a shirt of the team that she lives 5 miles from.
Is that because the product availability in the United States is better or cheaper, maybe?
Cheaper, I don't know why, but I'm like, really? I'm like, why?
There's no explanation. I thought there was going to be a
so
a turn
what,
in that
what
story.
I now have to do is go online somewhere and probably buy the shirt, then pay the shipping from England to get it here. Because for some reason, she couldn't buy it back there. Hmm. So all I'm saying is, it is now a global brand.
I feel like there's more to the story there.
No, I mean, there really
isn't. The big thing I noticed this year is there's so many more, and they're not really – well, actually, Chevrolet is on the front of Manchester United's jerseys now, and I don't even know – I mean, I know Chevrolet's in England, but I don't really know how big a presence.
Chevy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, but it looks horrible on their shirt, by the way.
I saw someone today on my way here going into my local coffee shop with a Tottenham Hotspur shirt, but not the first team shirt, the away shirt. I didn't know if he was from England or not. But I see people everywhere here on the streets wearing their team shirts. Now, I know, I don't really think that back in the UK there are people wanting, maybe, you know, you see a lot of people with sort of baseball caps and stuff because it's kind of cool as a fashion item. But not to the extent here.
Here you're declaring. I mean, there's one element to this that it's right now it's in that wave where it's cool and trendy. And so people wearing their jerseys, it's a declaration not only of your team, but the fact that you pay attention.
Okay.
And, you know, yeah. But I will say, what I was about to say, conveniently, soccer jerseys are just better stuff to wear than any American sports. Like, right, you know, like if you want to, you can wear a replica jersey and it's a shirt. You know, it's not like wearing a baseball, top with the buttons.
I think a baseball jersey is kind of cool.
Closer.
But
football jersey or the basketball tank top kind of thing. Those things look goofy. Did you just call it a basketball vest?
Well, yeah, because it's like, it is a vest, isn't it? Well. I mean, a vest, I always think of it as that type of an undergarment.
Yeah. Tank top or whatever you call them.
Okay. Yeah. We call them vests.
It's pretty good. Anyway, so pick a team. You know, we're going on for a while. So, you know, I was going to give you not deep suggestions. I think we've done some of this before.
We have done a bit of this.
But, you know, if you like me
you
better.
You need to be careful now because when you do suggestions, you end up, you know, insulting either areas of the country or areas of the world. Go back to our best of episode or our World Cup special, and Eric is busy putting the boot into various states in America and using very broad stereotypes and generalizations.
Overspinning it.
Okay.
So if you like me better, pick Chelsea, because I'm a Chelsea follower, London team. If you like Zeff better, and also you like really...
If you're a winner.
No. If you like years and years of futility, go with Arsenal.
Thank you very much. Always up
towards the top. Did win some silverware last year, but that's about it. You know, if you... You know, you could pick them just based on, like, if you like front runners, the one thing about the league, for anybody who hasn't followed it, it doesn't have a level of parity. It has more parity than it has historically, but it doesn't have a level of parity like it does in American sports. People don't come and go.
Yeah.
Tends to be the team. I think right now they're saying, like, basically, you have the same basic four teams up top, which would be Manchester City, Man United, Arsenal, and Chelsea. Now Liverpool is cracking into there, and then you get
Tottenham
and Everton. So it's sort of like a seven now that are in competition for those top four spots, and then you have all these teams that are in the mid level kind of thing. But you know, you could pick your team based on that. Like some people say, I don't want to be. I'd like to pick a front runner.
But also pick a team based on what team you like now. If you like the Red Sox, I would probably suggest Liverpool, not just because they're owned by the same people, but also because they're both vaguely annoying.
Yeah.
They sort of live in the past.
Used to be.
And isn't our history
great. Well, I remember that Arsenal book that got translated into the Red
Fever
Sox.
Fever Pitch,
which was a horrible movie. But you could just pick it based on the colors. You like blues better, pick one of the blue teams.
Yeah.
There's like a plethora of teams that are a claret, like a maroon and light blue this year. I think there's like three different teams in the Premier League that have the same basic jersey.
I think that's the other thing too, to get back to this notion of it as a fashion thing rather as a sporting thing. You're right about soccer jerseys in that, especially when you get to these club kits, there are different designs. You've got contrasting colored sleeves, you've got stripes, whereas unfortunately, for better or for worse, an American NBA or NFL jersey is one color.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, there's no like, and if there's no like diagonal snash.
And a lot of them have like cartoon logos on the front.
So there is, it's a very sort of hip and trendy.
Yeah. So, you know, the English, other than the fact that they'll always have a brand on the front, you know, that's their sponsor. Their crests are usually fairly classic looking, you know, off on the chest there. And so you can always get, like, if you don't get a jersey, you get a nice polo shirt that has an interesting crest on it. It's kind of not too bad. Our hats are pretty cool looking. You know, of course, I was just realizing this is really obviously for the American listeners, not for for the European listeners who probably have other reasons to pick teams. But if you're you know, there's a number of U.S. players that are over there. Tim Howard, you know, who got a lot of celebrity. He plays for Everton. He recently said he's going to ratchet back his international work. I think he's sort of ducking out of the international.
But that's a good reason to jump on that team now.
Yeah, Everton's a good reason.
Someone that you know.
Yep. And he's been the backup goalkeeper, Brad Guzan, who's now going to be the number one. Brad Guzan.
Okay, but who does he play?
Oh, Aston Villa. He's Aston Villa's starting keeper.
Aston Villa owned by an American.
That's right. Yeah, a number of these teams are
Arsenal and Liverpool.
Manchester United.
And Manchester United, yeah. So that could be a reason.
And Fulham, but they went down.
But if you support the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in America,
right.
Well, why don't you support Manchester United? Because the people that own your team own that team.
Right, right.
That's a good reason.
And then Stoke has Jeff Cameron plays for them, although I don't think he's starting right now. DeAndre Yedlin, who was a big hit in that last.
He's not going there until like a year from now or something like that,
but he'll be headed over there. I can't remember if there's any other Americans playing right now currently. You know, Clint Dempsey played for Fulham for years and then briefly for Spurs before they left. And then, of course, Landon Donovan played for Everton before in the past. So who knows? Maybe he'll reappear there.
Yeah. So I think Everton is actually quite good for people trying to get involved.
Everton's a nice one because it's in that middle level. You're not really picking a front runner, but you're at least picking a team you know is going to hang around.
And I want to say this. If you pick a team like Everton, you're actually – there's nothing worse than seeing all these guys in any sport.
They have a nice-looking blue uniform.
But also all these guys always pick teams like the hot team.
Yeah.
And you're so clearly a bandwagon jumper, which is the worst part of being the worst type of fan. But if you are some of those people and you pick Everton or Aston Villa, you might not know anything, but at some level, you give off street credibility.
Exactly.
Oh, that guy knows.
Yeah,
otherwise, he would have
just paying enough attention.
He would have just picked Manchester United like everyone else. And I really respect
that. I get some grief for Chelsea, but Chelsea was actually thrown onto me by a friend like 20 years ago, maybe longer ago, that he was sort of like, you guys should all follow, but he was way ahead of the curve.
But you've been to the stadium, you've made the pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. There's you have some street credibility.
Some.
Not on your opinions about animals, but... So basically, the Premier League is a bit like the War of 1812.
Yeah, it's taking the war.
Yeah, and it's taken over America.
Yeah. So that's all our topics for today, I think.
That's it for today. Yeah, we did war, so there you go.
Yep.
Anything else on the docket? Is there anything people can see on the YouTube channel?
You know, I never published that one we did the last time, so I could always release that.
Are we going to put me doing the ice bucket challenge?
Yes, if you want to put out your ice bucket challenge.
That next time. We are going to talk about the ice bucket challenge next time, which seems to be this viral internet phenomenon. I don't even think I pronounced that correctly. We'll talk about that next time because I did it, and I think my partner may well put it up on our YouTube channel. One, you can actually see one of us, but I will be drenched with water.
Actually, you know, to put it on your YouTube channel, you would have to put it onto YouTube.
I don't know how to do that. You handle that.
Do you really want that on YouTube?
Yeah, what do I care? How many people are going to our YouTube channel?
Well, the point is somebody could just – people wouldn't have to go to our channel. They could just search on YouTube – and you're going to come up. You know, in other words, if somebody just ran a regular group, we'll talk about this afterwards.
Okay, all right.
we're doing administrative matters to wrap this up.
I could go viral.
Yeah, you might not want that.
All right, fair enough. Anything else?
Nope.
This has been the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
Yeah, I'm Eric. Take care.
You've just enjoyed Eric and Zeph on the Atlantic Voice Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at @Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at atlanticvoice.net. Email us at atlanticvoice@gmail.com. And now on YouTube, search for The Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.